It's good to see everybody here. Thanks for being here this morning, and I'm looking forward to our Bible study as we're getting towards the end of the book of Job. Pull that down a little bit. We are looking through the section where Elihu is speaking, and going to look at chapters 35, and we'll try to get through 36 today as well. So we're coming kind of to the back end of the arguments he's making. Just to recap from chapter 34, Elihu in chapter 34 was arguing against Job's conclusion that God does not distinguish between the righteous and the wicked. That was pretty much his focus in chapter 34. And he talks about first, God has a right to rule. He establishes that nobody tasked God with keeping track of the earth, right? But that's basically authority begins and ends with God. There's no one higher than him who could give him a job to do. But he puts that upon himself. And Elihu then argues that God will not do wrong, and he's going to repay man according to man's works, that indeed he does distinguish between the wicked and the righteous. And we talked about one of the implications of Elihu's argument is that God has to be perfect in his ability to judge, according to Elihu, or how I read Elihu, that God has to be perfect in his ability to judge, because if he isn't, then we can't trust our own sense of judgment, because we got the concept of judgment and our ability to judge from him, because as Elihu establishes, there's nobody higher than God who could have taught God these things. So it came from God. And if what came from God is tainted and unreliable, then what can we say about our own ability, right? So it's a pretty good argument, I thought. But Elihu's talking, I think, to make the point that, look, you're discrediting your own sense of justice, Job, if you challenge God's. And if your own sense of justice is discredited, then how can you expect to accuse God of anything rightly? It's unreliable, right? Your judgment's unreliable. So how can you bring it before God and accuse him of any wrong? Pretty good arguments, I think. Chapter closes with Elihu, who's arguing that a man who's rebelled against God has no right to petition God or to reason with him or try to ask God to teach him where he's gone wrong. I think Elihu is trying to tell Job, instead of going before God and saying, show me what I did wrong, how about you repent? You're in rebellion. Don't be so presumptuous as to think that you're just innocently rebelling against God. Obviously, there's something you need to fix in your life that's causing these things to happen to you. So let's focus on that rather than thinking you can go before God and try to make your case to him. So we spoke a little bit, too, as we do, as I've sent out writings about what I think about Elihu's discourse. I think Elihu makes a lot of really interesting and a lot of good points, but I also think ultimately he's misapplying them to Job. I think that he is assuming that Job did something to deserve this, which we know isn't true. We have the benefit of Job's chapter 1 and 2, or Job chapters 1 and 2, where we can see that it has nothing to do with Job, right? That this happened because there were things going on that Job really had no influence over. He just became kind of the subject of this discussion between God and Satan. So knowing then that Elihu's assumption that Job is guilty is flawed, which we do, I think we can say it's flawed, it causes us to question Elihu when he claims to speak for God, because Elihu very clearly does claim to speak for God. He believes that he is God's mouthpiece. So that causes us to question him. And we're going to see some more of that as we get into chapters 35 and 36. Especially in 36, he says some very bold things about how he is perfect in knowledge, and one who is perfect is with you. And hear what the Lord has to hear, what God has to say. That type of language. So red flags going off all over the place. But we talked about, too, like one application for us is when we're talking to others about matters of religion and how we can sometimes, I think, relate to the situation Elihu was in. he's hearing this debate going on between Job and his friends, and he's hearing things said like, God does not distinguish between the righteous and the wicked. And Job did very much say that. Job said that in chapter 9, if you go all the way back to there. And you can see Elihu, you can picture him listening to this and thinking to himself, like, well, someone's got to say something, right? I mean, he can't be right in those things that he's saying, but yet he's taking his friends to task. His friends can't keep up with him. He's a better debater than they are. Someone's got to say something, right? So he feels this urge to speak up. And we can relate to that. But I think what we can learn is, like, let's be careful when we are trying to talk to others about matters that are right, about trying to teach them about God. We talked about be careful about maintaining humility and being ready to listen to other people, because we want them to listen to us. So if we're not willing to listen to what they have to say, we're asking them to do something we ourselves are not willing to do. And I think that a lot of people who are serious about wanting to have a discussion with us are going to pick up on that pretty quick. And it's going to inhibit a real conversation. And what I didn't want to come off as last week, and I'm afraid I may have, is I didn't want to discourage people from talking to other people. Right? I didn't want to try to tell people, like, look, don't go out and talk unless you're really, 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 really ready to do it. But rather, what I'm trying to say is be prepared to make an investment in that person. Don't go into it with the mindset of, I have an argument to win, or I have a point that I need to convince them of. But rather, go into it thinking, like, this is someone whose life I'm willing to make an investment in. And I think if you approach it from that point of view, that might be beneficial. And I think you'll soon see that whether or not they're willing to reciprocate on that level. Some people really are, I think, just out to debate. But it's just never been productive in my experience, which isn't vast, but it's not productive to just look at people as purveyors of some point of view. But they're people. I mean, this is someone that God created who's going to have a mix of right ideas and wrong ideas. They're going to have some things that they're really trying to do sincerely and some things that maybe they've compartmentalized in their mind or they're not being consistent on. Maybe they haven't realized that yet, or maybe they have. You know, it's going to be all over the board. But that's what I'm asking is be ready to make an investment in people. So with that in mind, let's get into Job chapter 35, looking at verses 1 through 4. And Elihu answered and said, "Do you think this to be just? Do you say it is my right before God? That you ask, what advantage have I? How am I better off than if I had sinned? I will answer you and your friends with you." So again, a reminder that Elihu is not very pleased with the answers that Job's friends have given to this point. In verse 1, it says, Elihu answered and said, that could be evidence that there was something that happened between Job chapters 34 and 35, and you have that in the beginning of 34 as well. Could just be a pause. It could be time for everybody to kind of sit and think for a minute about what he said. Maybe something was exchanged at that time. But you have Elihu again picking up his discourse here in chapter 35. And in verses 2 and 3, you have Elihu coming back around to this idea that Job seems to think he has a right to question whether God treats sinners and the righteous equally, which of course would be unjust if God were that way. So now Elihu's about to answer this. And in verse 5, he begins his argument. He says, "Look at the heavens and see, and behold the clouds, which are higher than you. If you have sinned, what do you accomplish against him? And if your transgressions are multiplied, what do you do to him? If you are righteous, what do you give to him? Or what does he receive from your hand? Your wickedness concerns a man like yourself, and your righteousness, a son of man." So when Elihu's beginning his argument here, he's pointing out that when a man sins, he hasn't accomplished anything at God's expense. He's not damaged God. He doesn't have the power or ability to do that because God is so much higher than him. And similarly, when a man is righteous, he hasn't proven that God needed his help with anything. He's not brought some benefit to God because, again, God is higher than him, according to Elihu. But rather, when we think about the effects that our righteousness or our wicked have, those effects are going to be seen in other people that are around us. When we act in an evil way, there are going to be people who experience that and are affected by that. If we have the ability to take advantage of a person, and we do, they're going to suffer, very, very simply. If we have an opportunity to help somebody, and we do, they're going to benefit from that. So we are the benefits of our own actions down here, us people, together. But that those benefits or consequences don't really affect God, according to Elihu. Okay? So this chapter is a little difficult for me because it's a little difficult for me to connect that observation as an answer to Job's question of how it would be better for him if he hadn't sinned. And I think some of this argument is going to appear a little bit disjointed to us. And I think one of the reasons for that is there is some difficulty in translating it. And we'll look at a couple of different translations as we go a little bit further on. But my shot at this is I think that the way Elihu is trying to take this observation and say it answers Job believing he has a right to question God is when we looked in chapter 34, you know, Elihu talked a lot about how God is impartial, and perhaps he's going down the same track here, that God is an impartial judge over all of us. He's not going to be swayed by having gained something from man. And he's not going to be swayed because he personally suffered some wrong at the expense of man's actions. But rather, God's going to punish the one who sins, and he's going to reward the one who's righteous in a very impartial, objective way that a judge should, right? And not become, I would say, so personally invested in it. I think that's kind of where Elihu's going with this, okay? But I leave that open to you guys. This is a little bit tricky. It's a little bit hard to understand some of these things. So any thoughts or comments or questions about any of that to this point? Seems I'm doing a smashing job. All right, so let's get even murkier. Let's go to verses 9 through 13. Elihu continues, "Because of the multitude of oppressions, people cry out. They call for help because of the arm of the mighty. But none says, 'Where is God, my maker, who gives songs in the night, who teaches us more than the beasts of the earth and makes us wiser than the birds of the heavens?' There they cry out, but he does not answer, because of the pride of evil men. Surely God does not hear an empty cry, nor does the Almighty regard it." All right, so this is, again, kind of a murky passage for me as well, but I'll give a stab at what I think Elihu is saying. I think that Elihu is now presenting a group of people in a hypothetical scenario who are being oppressed by the wickedness of others. Okay? Now that he's got this hypothetical group of people who are being oppressed, he's going to present two different reactions they could take to that oppression. All right, the first reaction is in verse 9, they cry out for help. They call out for help. That's one reaction we can take when we're being oppressed. We call out to God to help us. The second reaction they could take is what I think you see in verses 10 through 12. Okay, I think that would be the reaction of them saying, "Where is God?" In a very accusing way. I think that when he says that, "Where is God who gives songs in the night, who teaches us more than the beasts of the earth and makes us wiser than the birds of the heavens?" It's an indictment that God is not there. It's like God is supposed to be here to give me hope, right? He's supposed to give me a song in the night, kind of this idea of hope. He's supposed to give me guidance and clarity that the beasts wouldn't have, right? He's supposed to give me that. So where is he? Where is he right now? I think that's how I read that. Okay, so you have two reactions. And I think that you see this summarized, if you just jump over to chapter 36 and verse 13, you have this type of person summarized very eloquently as Elihu comes back around to this in verse 13, where he says, "The godless in heart cherish anger. They do not cry for help when he binds them." So this is the kind of person that when they suffer some injustice, they feel indignant about it, and they feel angry that God would allow it, rather than seeking God to help them sincerely. And I can certainly relate that if that's what he means, that that's certainly something that I think we see, right? Those are two very real reactions I think people have when bad things happen to them. One person turns to God and asks for help. Another person says, "Where were you? Where were you, and why did this happen to me?" So when Elihu, going back to chapter 35, in verse 10, when he says, "But none says, where is God my maker?" I think he's saying nobody speaks this way. That means like a rebuke to anyone who would say something like this. I think he's saying like no one sensible would say something like this. Right? That's not the way to go. He's trying to angle towards you should petition God for help rather than blame God for what happened. Right? So he's saying it's not good. No sensible person would speak this way when they're oppressed, but they should turn to God for help, not be angry because this happened to them. And then in verse 13, "Surely God does not hear an empty cry, nor does the Almighty regard it." So I think the idea there is that God will listen to those who sincerely ask him for help, but he's not listening to someone who says, "Where were you?" I think that's what Elihu's trying to say. That's my best shot at working through that section. I don't know if you guys had a chance to dig into it any more than that, if you have any other ideas about what it might mean. You're certainly welcome to share. Yeah, Britt?
What about the omission in verse 12 of the cry? That seems to be another one of his callbacks all the time. That's the reason. If your cry out comes from your pride, it doesn't come from actually wanting God to help you. It comes from that indignation that how dare somebody do this to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right on kind of hopefully what I was trying to explain. I think you're right, or I agree with you on that both people are crying out, but what is the motivation behind the crying, right? The first people are crying out because they need help. They're asking sincerely. The second group of people are crying out because they're indignant. They're crying out to God, "Where were you? Why? How could you allow this to happen?" With that type of attitude. Yeah, Kelly?
Yeah, I read this somewhat. I read 9 through this whole section of kind of the same narrative. I was thinking back to when the children of Israel were being oppressed because they had not driven out the nations that God had told them to drive them out. They began to be oppressed by those nations and they cried out to the Lord. Now, I think in that context, God did show mercy to them, though they really probably, in one case, weren't really seeking God. But because he was merciful to them, because he loved them and was moved with pity toward them, gave them a deliverer, you know, in that sense. So I think, and in fact, we were just reading Revelation about when God sends part of the plagues, that people cry out and gnaw on their tongues, but they don't repent of their evil doing. Mm-hmm. They curse God instead of saying, "It's because of our own evil that we're suffering this way. Let's turn back to God." So I guess I read this, and I'm going to think about it some more, but verse 9, he says that people cry out. I think it's they're crying out because they're being oppressed. Suffering, and they're saying, "You know, this is wrong. This is bad. This shouldn't be happening to me." And I think he's making the observation. This is what I read in verse 10. But none is saying, "Where is God my maker?" Meaning, let's seek after God.
Mm. I like that. Yeah, that fits pretty well too. I like that.
They're suffering, but the thing they should be asking, "I'm going to pray to God and ask God for help through this. I don't understand what's happening here."
Right.
Instead, they're not doing that.
So reading verses 10 through 11 as that's the sincerity that should have been there,
that's
but
the
isn't. I like that. That fits. That fits well. Yeah, that
and
fits
I
well.
I think that dovetails pretty well into his final argument because of the pride of evil men.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, that's my.
Yeah. No. Appreciate your thought. And I think certainly the problem is there's some insincerity there. And I think bringing it back around to how Elihu is handling Job, he thinks Job needs to repent and he isn't, right? So I think he sees Job's request to petition God as being insincere. I like that. That's really good. Thanks, Kelly. Yeah, Billy?
I think I'm seeing the same way as Kelly, where in verse 9, verses 9 and 10, he says the people call out because they're being oppressed. In verse 10, he says, but none of them says, "Where is God?" They're just crying out. In verse 11. are crying out to God, so verse 12, they cry out and he doesn't answer because of the pride. They're not appealing to him. They're just asking for, they're just crying out, but they're not asking for God to help them.
Mm-hmm.
And then in verse 13, he says, God doesn't hear an empty cry, nor does the Almighty regard it. In other words, I think this falls in line with the idea that you have it. God doesn't hear the prayer of the sinners. Not he doesn't hear what people are saying, but he doesn't regard the prayers of someone who's not actually coming to him. Somebody who just generally wants help is different than someone who wants help from God.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think he takes that idea, and then he goes in 14, how much less do you say if you don't see him? Now you have a person who knows about God and is even further rebelling in his mind,
mm-hmm.
what he thinks of Job. He's saying, not only are you not doing that, you're just crying out in general that you're upset. You're actually taking God to task, and you think he's going to hear you?
Yeah.
So that's what I'm seeing in comparison of ungodly people with a person who is anti-God in his view of Job. That if you're worse, you're not just generally crying out. You're actually calling God to account for this.
Right. Yeah.
You think God's going to hear that? I think that's what I read.
Yeah, yeah, and definitely what you have is Elihu is then taking it a step further and saying that Job has gone beyond this initial example of a transgression, right? Job has taken it a step further, right? So it's definitely an indictment against him. Let's go ahead and read those verses. But appreciate y'all's thoughts. That's really good. That may be more right on than what I was saying, because that does fit pretty well. But you do have them crying out for help, but not willing to change, which would, again, fit a lot of what Elihu has been accusing Job of doing. It fits very well with chapter 34. So let's see. Let's just look at verse 13 again and read through the end of the chapter. He says, surely God does not hear an empty cry, nor does the Almighty regard it. How much less when you say that you do not see him, that the case is before him and you are waiting for him. And now because his anger does not punish, and he does not take much note of transgression, Job opens his mouth in empty talk. He multiplies words without knowledge. So I think, again, kind of like what Billy was saying, you know, Job is more similar to this man who becomes indignant when he suffers or who refuses to repent rather than doing what he needs to do to rightly petition God for help. But Job's situation is worse because, you know, like Billy is saying, he knows about God. And I also think you have this situation, too, where think about Elihu believes that Job kind of brought this on himself. It's not like Job is suffering at the hands of someone else like this example. You know, in this other example, you have people oppressing other people. And you have the victims of that oppression. Again, great example going back to, like, you know, the Israelites in Egypt, you know, they cried out when they were oppressed by other people. But now, even worse than that, Job, this is your fault. You know, this isn't the fault of the Egyptians. You've done this to yourself because of your pride. I think that's the point that he's trying to make. So how much worse is it then when you're bringing it on yourself? So again, we see very clearly, I think, Elihu believes that Job is in rebellion. In verses 15 and 16, there's a lot of different views on what these verses mean, such to the point that it kind of seems clear to me that we probably lost something in the translation of these verses, because even if you look at different translations, they're pretty different from each other. Some versions of the Bible have tried to translate this in a way that gives meaning to it, to help us understand what it means, and other translations have been just kind of a straight literal from Hebrew, and they look pretty different to each other. Neither option has really helped me much in having a perfect understanding of what this means in verse 15 and 16, when he says, because his anger does not punish and he does not take much note of transgression, Job opens his mouth in empty talk, he multiplies words without knowledge. My best shot at it at this time is that the fact that God hasn't, you know, like, struck Job dead for his blasphemy seems to have emboldened Job to continue to blaspheme. That's kind of what I read it as. So any other thoughts in chapter 35 before we get into 36 a little bit? Yeah, Kelly? One of the, hopefully this will go along with your comment. One of the things that I find difficult in studying the book of Job, and especially like in this section where Elihu is talking, is I don't think that what he's saying is right, at least to the context of applying it to Job. I think we've established, at least I'm convinced, that he believes Job is guilty of something that Job didn't do. So given that we know, I think reasonably, that Elihu's not speaking accurately, and that he claims to be speaking for God, it kind of it opens the door to a variety of interpretations, because now you've kind of lost your anchor of allowing other verses that we trust in to inform us on what he means here, because what he could mean is just whatever he's thinking, right? So it's kind of hard to work through some of that. So tricky stuff. Right, it's tricky stuff. And what makes it more complicated is I think Elihu makes some great points. And if you remove the misapplication of those points onto Job, and if you kind of take away some of the stuff he's about to say here in the first four verses of chapter 36 that seem pretty brazen to me, I amen a lot of it. I think, wow, you know, he's really making some good points here. Yeah, Billy? Yeah, and Elihu's arguments along those lines and what we're going to see even in the next chapter or two, I believe are so effective, and they are so in line with what God teaches. It is the strongest evidence for people who believe that Elihu actually is speaking for God. So I don't outright dismiss that view. But again, I just have a really hard time reconciling that with the fact that he's accusing Job of something Job didn't do, and he's claiming to speak for God. And very specific things. Right, right. All right, so first four verses of Job chapter 36. And Elihu continued and said, "Bear with me a little and I will show you, for I have yet something to say on God's behalf. I will get my knowledge from afar and ascribe righteousness to my Maker, for truly my words are not false. One who is perfect in knowledge is with you." Red flags. Red flags. Continuing on. "Behold, God is mighty and does not despise any. He is mighty in strength of understanding. He does not keep the wicked alive, but gives the afflicted their right. He does not withdraw his eyes from the righteous, but with kings on the throne he sets them forever, and they are exalted. And if they are bound in chains and caught in the cords of affliction, then he declares to them their work and their transgressions, that they are behaving arrogantly. He opens their ears to instruction and commands that they return from iniquity. If they listen and serve him, they complete their days in prosperity and their years in pleasantness. But if they do not listen, they perish by the sword and die without knowledge. So again, you can read that verse and you can immediately start thinking about these kings that we read about in the rest of the Bible and how this literally happened to them. I mean, kings of Israel, kings of Judah. You think about Nebuchadnezzar, how he was humbled and how his senses were returned to him. And all these examples that go along with what Elihu is saying. But I'll just offer too that it's not always how God operates. Sometimes there are wicked men who are put in place and they're just there doing bad stuff for a long, long time. Sometimes that happens. And then in verse 13, we already looked at this. But the godless in heart cherish anger. They do not cry for help when he binds them. Man, I absolutely love this verse. You know, again, coming back to, you know, whether or not my understanding of chapter 35 is accurate, I kind of interpreted it in view of this verse coming up in chapter 36. But the principle is there, right? There's two reactions. Are we going to cry for help, or are we going to cherish anger in our heart when bad things happen to us? And again, I think Elihu is wrong in general to apply these concepts to Job, but this is a gem right here. I mean, this is a great, great verse. Yeah. Yeah.
Worldly sorrow. So it does, this principle hits home, because it's the complexity is not, or what we're struggling with are not who people grieve, but the sincerity behind it. So it all hits home. It's very humbling.
Yeah.
A sincerity checker.
Very, very practical. Causes me to think about some things. Continuing on, verse 14, they die in youth and their life ends among the cult prostitutes. You know, I think the idea there being that in their indignation and in their anger at what's happened to them, they go seek comfort in something very worldly and very accessible. And again, I think we can relate to that, right? We can relate to that. He delivers the afflicted by their affliction and opens their ear by adversity. He also allured you out of distress into a broad place where there was no cramping. And what was set on your table was full of fatness, but you are full of judgment on the wicked. Judgment and justice seize you. So verse 15, back to this idea that he presented, I believe, first in chapter 33. Remember when we talked about this, whoever this angel was, this interceding person on our behalf who sees man suffering and then petitions God. And after, you know, offering whatever this ransom is, God then hears the prayers of this person. This is all according to Elihu, right? So we take it with a little bit of a grain of salt. But the idea leading to ultimately, Elihu is describing that suffering is a cyclical process of restoration. God's going to cause you to suffer because you did something wrong, and he intends for you to repent and be restored. You suffer because it's an opportunity for you to realize you need God. And then through that process, you're restored by it. And I think verse 15 is hitting that. He delivers the afflicted by their affliction and opens their ear by adversity. They go through a tough time, and now they're more willing to listen to what God has to say than they are when they're just doing great. And then you have, I think, in verse 16, this deliverance that happens. And it also seems to be that Elihu is now turning it back around to Job, because he says you. He says, he also allured you out of distress into a broad place where there was no cramping, and what was set on your table is full of fatness. But then in verse 17, but you are full of judgment on the wicked, judgment and justice seize you. So it's almost to me like Elihu's telling Job that God's done his part. He's delivered you in a sense, and you rejected him. Like you've kind of taken it for granted. Right, and you're acting wickedly, even though he's done these things for you. In verse 16, this idea that he lured you out of distress, The Hebrew wording there is interesting because it actually is talking about this idea of God pulling a person out of this narrow hole, right? Like they're confined like in this hole, and he's taken them out of that narrow hole, and he's placed them in kind of a broad space, like an open field. And I don't want to just rush past that. That's something that, so several nights ago, I actually had a dream kind of like along these lines. And it was really, really troubling to me. Well, what's the most troubling thing is like I hadn't really given a whole lot of consideration to this specific passage, but as I'm preparing for this class, I'm like, yeah, I kind of dreamed about this a few nights ago. And it was an awful dream. It's one of the most panic-inducing dreams I've ever had. But in my dream, I was in like a dark, narrow hole. And it's like if you ever see like in movies or something of like these like sewage pipes that people have to crawl through for some reason, and there's really no room to do anything but just keep moving forward. It was about like that. So I'm tight in this hole, and I'm sinking in it. Like the platform or something below me is moving, and I'm moving down. And I can see above me the light is getting smaller and smaller and smaller as I descend downward. And I'm having to battle like a panic attack because like in my mind I'm thinking like, this is just where I'm going to be now, right? I'm going to be forever descending away from where I used to be on the surface, just stuck in this narrow hole, no room to move, no room to do anything, in darkness, you know? And I mean, literally in my dream, I'm like starting to hyperventilate. Like I'm trying to like prepare myself for like, okay, I can't lose my mind here. Like I can't lose my mind here. And then this scene changed and I'm back on the surface. And it's like just the whole dream, just like, okay, we're done with that. We're back, we're on to something new. And like somehow I'm like in a hotel for some reason in Las Vegas with Bonnie. Like we're... Maybe I shouldn't be teaching you guys. I don't know.
We're talking about false prophets.
Timely as always. Timely as always. But I only want to bring that up because, man, this passage really struck a chord with me. You know, I think that we're to read verse 16 as, you know, when God punishes the unrighteous. And I don't know that's what was happening in my dream, but I don't associate necessarily what was happening to me with God punishing me, but that imagery is there, and that's what I relate to, right? But the idea that when God punishes, it's terrifying, and when we're delivered from that, it should be a sobering reminder of how much we rely on him to rescue us. And it's not something that we should take for granted. And we see as Elihu talks about, he doesn't just rescue us, but he pours blessings on us, right? He prepared a table for Job, the table full of fatness, right? He gave Job great things, not just I pulled you out of the hole. Now, what more do you want? You know, I mean, he's preparing him all these blessings that he can experience. And those experiences should lead us to praise God and to thank God. And to remember that we don't want to go back to where we were. And I think that the rebuke that Elihu is bringing now on Job is that's not how Job responded, but as is evidenced apparently to Elihu by Job's continual suffering, Job must be full of judgment on the wicked, and judgment and justice seize you, or full of the judgment on the wicked, meaning that... God is judging him, that he's full of God's judgment, that God would judge upon the wicked. Job is the wicked. I think that's what he's trying to say here. Again, then verse 18, he says, "Beware lest wrath entice you into scoffing, and let not the greatness of the ransom turn you aside." Again, this is a difficult passage. There's different translations here that seem to lead us down very different meanings. I'm reading from the ESV, and the King James is actually, in my opinion, a little more intelligible, but they both could be right how they do it. The King James Version reads, "Because there is wrath, beware lest he take thee away with his stroke, then a great ransom cannot deliver thee." So I think the idea there would be that's a warning to Job that eventually he will reach a point in his rebellion where there won't be this ransom offered anymore that could appease God's wrath, because he's taken it for granted to that point. And then the ESV, the way it renders it, says, "Beware lest wrath entice you into scoffing, and let not the greatness of the ransom turn you aside." It may have something to do with Job feeling pride, according to Elihu anyway. Remember, this is his perspective, that Job feeling prideful that this ransom was offered for him for some reason. Like, wow, look how great I am that these spirit beings are now talking about me and trying to help me out. I don't know. Rather than feeling humbled and grateful, it would maybe perhaps exalt him. Just a couple of options there. I'm not sure which way to go. Verse 19, "Will your cry for help avail to keep you from distress, or all the force of your strength?" It's a hypothetical question, or rather a rhetorical question is what I meant to say. A rhetorical question, the answer is no. We're ultimately powerless to prevent all this from happening to us. Verse 20, "Do not long for the night when peoples vanish in their place. Take care, do not turn to iniquity, for this you have chosen rather than affliction. Behold, God is exalted in his power. Who is a teacher like him? Who has prescribed for him his way, or who can say you have done wrong? Remember to extol his work, of which men have sung." So remember, when Job originally started talking, he was speaking about how he really wanted darkness. He wanted to be someplace where God wasn't, and he was just wishing for deep darkness, and Elihu is rebuking him now. He's saying, no, don't wish for that, but accept the affliction and watch God perform his process of restoration through it. Let God teach you through this trial. So let's just finish up here real quick. He says, "Behold, God is exalted in his power. Who is a teacher like him? Who has prescribed for him his way? Who can say you have done no wrong? Remember to extol his work, of which men have sung. All mankind has looked on it. Man beholds it from afar. Behold, God is great, and we know him not. The number of his years is unsearchable. For he draws up the drops of water. They distill his mist and rain, which the skies pour down and drop on mankind abundantly. Can anyone understand the spreading of the clouds, the thunderings of his pavilion? Behold, he scatters his lightning about him and covers the roots of the sea. For by these he judges people. He gives food in abundance. He covers his hands with the lightning and commands it to strike the mark. Its crashing declares his presence. The cattle also declare that he rises." So all these great acts of power and provision for his creation are being gone through here by Elihu. And those acts, I think, in verse 31, he says, "For by these he judges the people, he gives food in abundance." You know, we ought to see him as a righteous and good and qualified, capable and willing judge over us. And we should trust him in that. We should have confidence in him in that. So I know I kind of blew through the second half of that chapter a little bit, but happy to get your thoughts on it if you want. Just let me know. And next time we're going to try to get into, well, we're going to cover Job chapter 37, and then maybe we'll start it into God's response in chapter 38. So thank you very much for your comments and questions.